Blog Talk Radio.
Come on, baby, make it hot. Ride the cock till you hit the spot. Come on, baby, make it hot.
Doing it doggy style. Wow, 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 yippee-yo, yippee-yo, bow, wow, yippee-yo, yippee-yo.
You know, I'm losing my sense of humor.
What?
I'm losing my sense of humor here.
Well, let's welcome the people first.
No, no. Wait until
No.
Wait until I do the right one. Hold on.
Oh, that.
Now, go ahead.
Well, welcome.
You know.
To a Philo Wednesday. This is an Onto Wednesday.
I was going to say, there's nothing but Onto going on.
Well, why don't we open up with the end of the Earth story? Because I got a feeling that might be relevant by tomorrow.
Yeah, no kidding.
You see, I know this safe that was playing the role of, Noah.
Uh-huh.
Otto Rosler. In case you haven't noticed, there was an experiment today over in Europe. I think it was in Geneva.
Sweden. Yeah.
With this 17-mile particle accelerator, the whole thing with Bugs Bunny. Plutonium space modulator. I'm going to blow up the Earth. And they did this experiment to recreate, as if we needed to do it, the Big Bang.
Uh-huh.
So they could figure out how matter was formed from nothing.
Right.
You know, I understand that scientists have this real head-scratching need to explore and experiment things and to prove something. But if the downside is that the Earth disintegrates, you know what? Smoke a J. Don't do this to us. So now you're telling me that there's earthquakes happening all over the planet now.
Yeah, let me tell you. Let's see. A 7.2 in Japan. A 6.6 in Indonesia,
uh-huh.
A 6.1 in Tehran.
This is all today?
Yeah, and a 5.8 in Santiago, Chile. And then, of course, there was one on Tuesday, which doesn't count, I suppose. Well, it counts, but not because of this. That was 6.1.
And
that
what?
In the
have
sea
the scientists
there.
Come out of their, drunken stupor with their crashing of the protons together, or... To acknowledge that this is happening, or we're still basically in somewhere in Egypt by that river?
I don't know. I haven't seen anything. Let me see if I can find something in the news real quick here. Let's see. Earthquakes. And I'll run it in the news.
Mm-hmm. By the way, Delgado's up, and he hasn't hit a home run yet tonight, I don't think. So.
About
time. About time, and he pops out. Ooh,
major earthquake in Iran. We know this, and hopefully Mariam's okay. I have a good friend over there. Let's see, China. Oh my. I don't see any news.
Well, they haven't cornered these guys yet to say that to have the W2FTF conversation.
No.
2 days ago, they were making hip-hop things on YouTube but having a good old time.
Mm-hmm. Yep, this is not good at all.
Yeah, I'm just, like I said, when the guy that was doing the naysaying was Otto Rosler of the Rosler Attractor, you pay attention because... The math this guy forgets is more than we'll ever learn. So he's doing the math, and he's saying, right here is where you form a black hole, and the Earth is consumed from the inside out and disintegrates in 50 months. You take your little experiment, and you go to a local bar, and you play paper football.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have some kind of 17-mile, you know, little game of skee ball with the protons. You know, I don't know, science.
Yeah, this is...
You filthy criminals.
This is nuts.
Well, we'll see where it goes. There's so many other things going on. The pig lipstick thing all over the place.
That was nice.
I'm fascinated with that. I am so fascinated with the daily mudslinging. There's a thing on my friend's site there. I think it's called the Wonka Sphere, something like that.
That's
it was in
nice.
One of my links. I'll get the link for you because it's a great link. And it basically evaluates the overall text of the conversation going on both sides of the aisle,
mm-hmm.
whether they're going negative or not. I wonder if lipsticks and pigs are constitute going negative. I don't know. Kind of neutral words, unless you start putting some context around it.
Yeah.
Let me take a look. I think it's called the Wonka Sphere.
Okay.
Well, I'm doing that. Mm-hmm.
Do you want me to play the Obama clip?
Oh, yeah, it's a mud meter. Yeah, why not?
By the John McCain campaign. Now, what the... What their campaign has done this morning is the same game that has made people sick and tired of politics in this country. They seize on an innocent remark, try to take it out of context, throw up an outrageous ad because they know that it's catnip for the news media. Some of you may have, I'm assuming you guys heard this watching the news. Right? I'm talking about John McCain's economic policy. I say this is more of the same. You can put lipstick on a pig, but it's still a pig. And suddenly they say, oh, you must be talking about the governor of Alaska. See, it would be funny. It would be funny, except, of course, the news media all decided that that was the lead story yesterday. They'd much rather have the story, this is the McCain campaign, would much rather have the story about phony and foolish diversion than about the future. This happens every election cycle. Every 4 years, this is what we do. We've got an energy crisis. We have education that we have an education system that is not working for too many of our children and making us less competitive.
All right, enough. So there you go.
Wow. You take a loaded tamale. You point it at your stomach, and you accuse me of pulling the trigger?
I was just watching The Odd Couple.
Really? Yeah. This is. This is The Odd Couple. I'm just there. So I'm over here now. I'm on wonkasphere.com, and there's a link. Why McCain and Obama are so different on the Wonkasphere mud meter.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm efforting that now.
Okay.
And because I want to know. I want to know why they're so different. It to me, it's just, you know, there's not a debate till the 26th. We've got, like, 2 more weeks of this crap. Not only when they get all their little, you know, 527 commercials in. Herman today driving around. Obama wants to teach you about sex before you know how to read.
Oh, God.
Yeah, with the sex ed in the kindergarten class. I just, if you rely on anything from the government or from the education system to learn anything about anything, you are a schnook.
That's
you're
right.
You're in a different category, schnook. Representing the schnook party, you know, attention came
nice.
On choppers. Yeah. Some of you out in the Wonka sphere, love this word, may have noticed that while Obama's mud level, how much negative language he uses when talking about McCain, has been consistently lower than McCain's mud level, the actual volume of statements from one about the other has been drastically different.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. McCain's press releases and published speeches average about 10 Obama mentions a day, while Obama mentions McCain once a day. The difference is caused by their definition of press release. Depends
mm-hmm.
what is. In Obama's case, only statements by Obama himself are being pushed as press releases. He almost never mentions McCain in these statements. McCain's campaign repackages or redistributes news stories or editorials by other media and counted as a press release, and those tend to be heavily negative on Obama. As a quasi-journalist, I don't think it's correct for McCain to be calling these redistributions press releases. On the other hand, the public and media don't care what they're called. It represents an advantage to McCain. There you go.
Personally, I think the guy's a phony.
Mm-hmm. So this is going to be interesting to see how they lead up to the debates, because one of the debates is over here at Hofstra in Long Island, actually. Could actually go to a debate this time. Get my debate on. So let's see. So here's the conservative buzz, lipsticks on pigs, political rhetoric, and overreactions. It's the same. It's the same event, right? It's just like this thing with the protons. The scientists are dancing in the streets, and the safes are watching earthquakes all over the place. But people that don't have the internet are like, their ass is up over a tea kettle today because there's an earthquake somewhere. They didn't even know what was going on.
Right.
Four earthquakes. Amazing. On the same day. All right. Obama poked fun of McCain and McCain's Palin's new change mantra. You can put lipstick on a pig, still a pig. You can wrap an old fish in a piece of paper, call it change. It's going to stink. We've had enough of the same old thing. The crowd apparently took lipstick as a reference to Palin, who described the difference between a hockey mom and a pit bull in a single word, lipstick.
Right.
So did Barack Obama mean his remark to be an oblique insult of Sarah Palin? That's what the campaign, McCain campaign, I love that one, McCain campaign wants you to believe. To which Obama responded, enough is enough. So this is no different than what Hillary was pulling on him 3 months ago. So to me, Hillary did him a favor, because of the 3 o'clock in the morning thing and all the other crap. He's so exhausted from the quagmire of stupidity he has to wade through to get to be elected in this country, that I think he's just waiting for it to end. I think he's just riding it out and saying, okay, what else? So Roger Kimball on the Pajamas Media, I'm a Pajamas Media reader, says that the campaign is guilty of the same whining that Republicans often accuse Democrats of exhibiting.
Mm-hmm.
Bad form of the Republicans to play this silly game. I do not know Sam I Am, Sarah Palin. I don't know her from Adam. But if she even noticed Obama's desperate little performance, her reaction should be to laugh. But not whine. Some jerk called you a pig, get a life. I would advise Obama to not reprise it. I would say it when my husband is in the room. Yeah, the fisherman will care. Mr. Secessionist. Hope that comes up in the debates. By the way, your husband publicly admitted he wanted the Alaska to secede from the Union, and you kind of quasi-backed it. Anything to say about that, Miss Country First? Or shall I get some more lipstick? It's going to be interesting. Anyway, that's we've gone from earthquakes to lipstick to pigs, so we've pretty much covered
just another earthquake.
Well, yeah, bimbo eruption, as it were, to use an old Clintonism. Hey, looky-loo, our guest is here.
Yes. Shall I grab the horn?
Sound the horn.
All right, I'm going to do that. Hang on a second. Let me find the thing on here. Here it is.
Okay, so the submarine
is pretty horny there, Dr. Mark.
Yeah, what can I tell you? We're leaving the dock here with the ultimate psychological pirate, Bill O'Hanlon.
I was just trying to put some lipstick on my pet pig. That's really hard to do. Did you know that?
Well,
they don't like it. They tend to eat all the lipstick you put on.
I can't wait for the Great Pumpkin to have something to say about this in October. Charlie Brown has to speak up on it. You watch this whole thing unfold from a completely different branch, a different perch from the average sape walking around. So when you see this stuff going on, from the semantic point of view and from the way it kind of plays on people's worldviews, what do you think is really happening underneath the, like, if you were going to put, like, your little interpretation on the crawl below it all, what would you say is happening as we come out of the pom-poms and the pep rallies and half of the debates?
Well, I'll tell you a story.
Right.
One time, the first book I ever wrote, I've written a bunch of books, the first book that I ever wrote, I wrote with a guy in England, and we traded off writing chapters, and I discovered that whoever wrote the first chapter you know, the first version of the chapter, their version sort of dominated the whole thing. And I think all this stuff is dueling stories. You know, you just see who somebody puts out a story and they say, hey, believe my story. This is my story. This is my story. And whichever story sticks, that's what happened. You know, when I was amazed in the previous election when they painted Kerry as unpatriotic. Mm. And Bush hadn't gone to war. He'd been, you know, doing whatever down in Texas or Alabama or wherever he was. And Kerry had been getting shot at. And they said, oh, he exaggerated how much he got shot at or whatever, that SWPO thing. I thought, well, that was a great story they told, and enough people believed it. And I think Obama's pretty good at deflecting these stories that they tell about him. But each party is trying to tell a story, and a lot of my work has been in psychotherapy, has been, what kind of story are you telling, and is that working for you? Does that help you move you along, or does that keep you stuck? Because you got to choose your stories carefully.
Yeah, I just see people basically, is this just trying to go directly to the base? The people are already going to be locked into these two guys, and the independents just watch it like a tennis match and just don't pay attention to it, or is this really winning votes?
I don't know. It's a hard question to answer. I don't know whether people answer polls correctly or whatever it may be, but it still looks pretty close. I thought it was a shoe-in for the Democrats this year because of the negativity towards the Republicans, but it doesn't look like it's a shoe-in.
So just kind of jumping off of that point, we're sitting here on the eve of September 11th again. It happens every year. we're here in New York, and Mayor Bloomberg is just reinforcing it all with his, he's diverting traffic and he's shutting down certain bridges at certain times and just making us all feel safe and warm. So how do you get past, I mean, maybe that we've gotten so conditioned to it lately, but how do you get past this sort of mindset that's been creeping through the culture of contingency mentality, the what-if mentality, where you talk about possibility as your primary means of communicating to people, where nothing is uncertain, nothing is certain, everything's sort of just, you know, up in the air, so to speak. And that's the exact sort of cloud that's over the people's heads when it comes to terrorism, because it's a tactic that you never know when it's going to happen. So you're almost like, you know, the star of your own horror movie in a way. You never know when something's going to come up to bite you. And the media is so just quick to push you there, quick to push you towards their fear, especially when you get to things like tomorrow.
I was watching a national television program, one of the national news programs, on one of the previous anniversaries of 9/11, and they had some psychologist type on there, and they said, what about the people from 9/11 there, you know, that were affected by 9/11 directly or indirectly in New York or, you know, Washington or in Pennsylvania, and, you know, what about those people? And the guy said, they'll never recover. They're going to be scarred for life. And I wanted to reach through the screen and grab his scrawny little neck, because I think one of the things, and, you know, I've called my stuff possibility therapy, because I'm interested in how people move on from these things. And one of the things that surprised people, the research didn't agree with that psychologist. The research says most people do bounce back from trauma. They're resilient. And especially the interesting research is the people in New York bounce back a little better and a little more quickly than most people do from trauma, because the whole community pulled together. I remember visiting New York afterwards, and I was there for a publishing meeting, and I was surprised at how friendly people were. Now, it didn't last, don't worry. New Yorkers went back to their usual, you know, honk the horn and give you the finger as a good morning sign. But
hey,
for a little while,
we're working here.
Yeah, you're working, that's right. That for a little while there was a sense of community, and one of the bits of research that says how people bounce back from terrible things is they pull together as a community and they get social support. There was a lot of social support for people who went through that, and the kind of predictions they said of how many people would develop post-traumatic stress, way fewer people develop post-traumatic stress. So I think one of the things is, you know, let's have a little faith in the resilience. And same thing about our economy. It looks really dark. It looks really terrible. It looks bad. Everything's collapsing. Subprime mortgages are going. The big banking houses are going. The government's got a big deficit. And one of the things that I always see is that I travel all around the world. Americans are really resilient. Once they figure out the new program, they say, okay, let's do this, let's do this, let's do this, and we'll make adjustments. And I wouldn't bet against America. The first time I went to Japan, Japan was in ascendancy in business, and I thought, man, you know, these people are going to take over the world. Then I got to Japan, and I thought, they're not going to take over the world. Their economy's not that great. They don't take care of their people really well, and they're really a rigid culture. America's really flexible, and I think that's one of the things that gives me hope, is that we bounce back from things. We do pull together when we need to. The rest of the time, it's kind of chaotic. Everybody blames everybody else, and nobody does anything until the bridge collapses, and then they say, oh, we got to put more money into the infrastructure. But once we figure out what to do, I think we're pretty good at it, so I believe in possibilities.
Mm-hmm. And again, this is sort of a play on the old Watts Wallach book, you know, The Situation is Hopeless but Not Serious.
Yeah, that's right.
Is that when people are faced with sort of life-defining events, whatever that happens during the course of their existence, there's this inner strength that showed up in the wake of 9/11 that is somewhat benevolent, somewhat harmonious, and the afterglow of it around here, you know, you're right, lasted until about when the anthrax started spilling all over the trains. Everyone started going, okay, everyone's the enemy, watch out. And then the duct tape came out and on we went. So how do you get people to internalize something that seems so ephemeral, almost like it's a tropical breeze that blows through, when most people, like I was looking at a book the other day called The Happiness Trap, that there's so much sort of false gods when it comes to the other end of the stick, when it comes to being blissful and sort of, you know, gregarious and open-minded, and then people take advantage of you, and you're downloading the secret, and you're reading the bleep books. And
yeah,
you're getting,
I think that's,
you know,
that's the problem. The secret about the secret is it leaves out one half of the human equation. It leaves out the dark side. So I'd say that's what, you know, I used to call my work solution-oriented, then people would come up to me and say, I love your positive approach to therapy, and a little shiver would run down my spine, thinking, you know, I don't really think of it as positive. That seems to me like you visualize enough and you get a good parking place, you know, when you're driving your car around. That seems magical thinking to me. That secret stuff, obviously, if you think negative, that's not so great. If you think positive, that's not so great. To me, that's why I call it possibility. You acknowledge the stuff that's not so great. You acknowledge that there's a pile of manure there. You don't just ignore it or put a gold covering over it. And then you clean it up or use it as compost. So there's a way to move into possibilities. And I think that, you know, I say that there's four energies in life. One is blissed and one is blessed. And those are the happy, positive energies. But the other two that really give energy to life is pissed and dissed. You know, what do you get angry about? And what do you feel disrespected about? What are you dissatisfied with? And, you know, I think that just listening to your show a little, you know, Mark, you've got a little pissed and dissed in you. You know, that comes
really
out. And maybe Val represents the bliss and blessed side a little more. You represent the pissed and dissed. I think all those energies are important in life. And, again, you go to New York City, and one of the things you find is there's a great energy. You know, there is a really great energy, but some of it's angry energy. Some of it's dissatisfied energy, and I think that's what makes it a kind of a great city in a certain way. You go there, and you feel like somebody's just plugged you into the cosmic wall socket, and you get energized there, and it's not all pleasant, happy-go-lucky energy. My younger brother, Naive, gets off the train there to visit my sister who's living there, and some guy says, hey, you know, I'll get you a taxi if you want. Mr. Naive gives him his only $50 bill. The guy disappears, and he gets in the taxi, and he doesn't have any money to pay the taxi. I think, you fool, you didn't know that about New York City. That's what people do. You got to keep your eyes and ears open and don't just be a naive Pollyanna trusting everybody. That's part of the city, and it's part of your learning in the city. It's great.
Well, so we talk about a lot of social identity factors, too, with our work, and it really is something that people don't make a differentiation about their personal identity. Maybe that's one of the things that in The Secret and the What the Bleep crowd they're talking about an internal experience that isn't necessarily shareable. It isn't necessarily something you have to transfer to the universe and everyone around you when evangelicizing. You know, so we had Stephen Hayes on the show a while back, you know, talking about acceptance and commitment therapy, his work, which sort of separates out your social from your personal identity.
Right. I think that's right. There's a sort of a choose the way it is and accept the way it is within. and then go out and make some changes in the world. But, you know, I love that thing about The Secret. I watched that DVD, and I was like, well, you know, there's some good stuff to it. But the one guy who had succeeded a lot, Jack Canfield, he said, oh, he taped, you know, $1 million, $100,000 check up on his ceiling or whatever. And then he got up every day and worked his butt off. And I thought, well, that's mm-hmm. The Secret. You know,
yeah,
you change your internal thing so you think it's possible, and then you get up every day and work your butt off to make that $100,000, not just lay there in your bed and think, wow, I'm visualizing it so strongly. It's deep in my heart. The world doesn't know anything about that. You got to go up and interact with the world and do something to make it happen. And that's what I call my stuff possibility therapy. It's acknowledgement of what's the way it is and stepping into the possibilities, not knowing what will happen when you step into the possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and this is, again, when you're looking at people that are on the cusp, that are in transition, whether it's a career change or a midlife crisis or the Mets blowing a 5-run lead, you know, like they're doing right now, and people get, they encounter this thing that affectionately we call their resistance, which is this tendency to sort of overprotect their weak spots and undersupport their strengths. How do you shift their attention from necessity? You know, I always tell people, that if you feed possibility, necessity gets the leftovers. But if you feed necessity, possibility dies in the driveway because you're coming from survival. So how do you shift someone's awareness from, you know, this sort of almost kind of a default setting to go into this overprotective mode, this kind of short-term, low-leverage way of acting into a much more broader scope that allows things to sort of nature take its course, to not take every experience as being black or white, and being final, as what people do. That's that fatalistic sort of worldview that I think it has a biological reality to it for survival, but in terms of evolution, in terms of your growth as a person, it doesn't serve you. How do you shift them out of that permanently, if it's possible?
I've written a couple of books about this. I wrote Change 101 and Do One Thing Different. And Change 101 was like seven ways that I've seen over 30-plus years as a therapist how people change. One way is the way that a lot of people change. They have to hit a crisis point where something wakes them up, kind of the 2x4 that gets their attention, and then they change. Another way, though, is to do one thing different. Change something small about how you view or do the situation. And then another way is they change in relationship to other people. That, you know, somehow interacting with somebody else, either they're a role model or they kick your butt and say it's time for a change, you know, or somehow they're benevolent influence or not so benevolent influence on you. Sometimes you say, I don't want to be like my parents when I grew up, or like my father, or like my mother, or I want to be like my father or my mother when I was growing up. Somebody else in relationship to you calls you to something else, gives you new input, inspires you, pisses you off, disses you. And I think those are the three main ways that I see people change. One is they get into a crisis, have a wonderful breakdown, and instead of just sitting there in the wallowing in the goop, they get up and they make changes because it's finally they've discussed it enough with themselves or the world or their situation. Another way is they do one small change that gets them out of the groove that they're in how they do things or how they view things. And the third one is they engage in relationships that change them.
If people could just listen to that 5 minutes of you giving them that answer, I think we'd save a lot of couches and a lot of therapy people. You know,
I think
a lot of
so
time.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, this is one of those things where I get sort of frustrated a little bit about it, because you're communicating a very lucid message there, but most people have their hands over their ears, their eyes shut, and their knees are chattering when they hear it, because it means, oh no, I'm responsible, and I use the phrase, ouch, I'm thinking, you know, and it's like at that point they're awakened to a much different worldview, where instead of the world being against them and thwarting them and sort of having this resistance that fight the world off, they go into a different worldview that is that pro-noia world where everyone's conspiring to make me happier because I'm open. and it just seems like a funny little it's a profound shift of attention that probably anyone ever makes. But you know, when you're dealing with people fearing change, and especially when it comes to things that matter to them that are external, like social status and things like that. Like,
yep.
You wrote a little ebook a while ago called The Lazy Man's Guide to Success or something like that.
Yeah, that's right.
It's on my shoulder somewhere in the pile. I don't know where it is.
Exactly.
And a great little book. And basically what it said was, find something you're very, very passionate about and go talk about it, or find something you're very, very passionate against and go and talk about it. Don't do anything in between, because if you do anything in between, you're not going to have that fire behind it. So how do you get people to understand the two strategies? Both of them lead to the same end. That if you're going to back something and be totally for it, say you're an environmentalist and you're going to get all behind the green movement or something like that, and you're going to become involved with the people that are talking, everyone's green, everyone's kissing bears, okay, great. Or you're going to be passionate against pollution and you're going to go the other direction. How do you get people to understand that both courses of action lead to the same destination when they have such a binary way of looking at stuff?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. What I can say is without juice, nothing happens. If you don't have the fuel in the tank, nothing happens, and that's the fuel. And I look around, you know, years ago I was hearing a therapist talk to a patient, and he said, you know, you're all messed up, but at least you're alive. And he said, look out the window, and there were a bunch of business people, this is during the 60s, walking to work in the same, wearing the same brown or gray or blue suit, carrying the same briefcase, and he said, those people are the walking dead. You're all messed up, but you're alive. And as long as you're alive, we can do something with that. And I thought, well, that's it. Hmm. Sometimes people are the walking dead. They're just walking around, living life, and they don't really tap into that aliveness until something wakes them up. And so I don't know what to say, how to get people's attention like that. Sometimes life gets their attention. Sometimes something inside them gets dissatisfied. But somehow, some way, can you wake up and pay attention to what's the battery for you in life, what's the juice for you in life. And until you get that, you know, I wrote that book, A Lazy Man's Guide to Success, because I was a couch potato lazy guy, didn't want to do anything, and all of a sudden I got seized by, you know, I got pissed off, actually, and it's what seized me, and I wanted to change some part of my world. And out of that, it so far has come 29 books, and, you know, I travel all around the world and I teach, and I've had way more success financially and in other ways than I expected, but it was nothing more. I certainly wasn't self-disciplined. I had a few talents, but not many. And I had to learn to write. I had to learn to speak. I was fearful of public speaking. But that passion that I had, the juice that I had, was stronger than any of those fears or any of those barriers or personality flaws. So, yeah, it's like Hunter Thompson used to say, I hate to recommend sex, drugs, and rock and roll, but they've always worked for me. And I would say I hate to recommend overwhelming passion that nothing will stop you with, but that's always worked for me.
Mm-hmm. Well. Mark.
Yeah. Sorry.
Mark, pay attention.
We had a little visitor there in the room. So I guess what I get is that you can have all the passion in the world. We have a lot of passion for somatics. We go out on the corner, we say somatics, people go, I think it's just past Cuba. They don't know what we're talking about. So how do you get to the point where you have a transferable passion where people can get
you
your message?
Speak their language. Who the hell cares about somatics? What they care about is my back hurts and I want something better. I have this terrible marriage and I want something better. You got to speak their language, and then you tell them about somatics once you get them hooked.
All right. So then the other side of this is that people kind of function within a lot of, like almost like Russian dolls, where you're dealing with the individual in relationship to themselves, and then you're dealing with them in terms of their intimate relationships, their families, their work environment. So this stuff about change and fear and all that other stuff, they could be the most, you know, gung-ho person in the group, but if they're surrounded by a bunch of deadheads that don't want to move anywhere and resist their change or resent their change or invalidate their change, how do you get them to ignore that or incorporate that into their process so that they're not waiting for the green light from 27 people to, you know, to change their exercise routine or whatever it is that they're trying to do? People, I see a lot, it's a Fight Club mentality. They seem to form a circle around whatever limitation it is that they've pedestalized and have a meeting about it. But when it comes to, you know, kind of galvanizing their own support, their own strength, they seem to look for help outside instead of inside. So how do you get them to say, you know, stop waiting for permission here?
I think you're right. But, you know, and the research indicates if people around you are overweight, you're more likely to be overweight. If the people around you smoke, you're more likely to smoke. If the people around you drink, you're more likely to drink. If the people around you are depressed, you're more likely to be depressed. But that's generally true, sociologically true. But then there are some people who are in a relationship where their partner smokes and they stop smoking, or their partner gains weight or is overweight and they start to make a change. So we all know that everybody does have that possibility to go against the grain, and then sometimes when they go against the grain, those relationships get challenged. Their friends, their family say, hey, don't change. We liked you the way you were. Even if you were all messed up, we liked you the way you were. And there's going to be those external voices as well as your internal voices saying, you can't really change, or who do you think you are? But some people do defy those inner and outer voices and those inner and outer restrictions, and they go change anyway. So, you know, all I can say is you can generalize, because people generally don't change except when they do, and you just got to look for the times when there's an opening and run through it, or the times when some people do change and use those as your role models.
Yeah, I tend to take the addiction model and kind of turn the sock inside out a little bit, that for everyone that's an addict that can point to, you know, all the enablers around them, there's people that are breaking free of those things that seem to have a lack of an ability to point to the disablers around them that want to see them stay where they are because it threatens them. And
yep.
It's like, you know, someone changes, like, you know, doubles their salary, or, you know, knocks 75 pounds off their butt or something, you know. Everyone around them is now, you know, we're difference engines for the most part. We say, wow, there's a difference with this person. Now I can't just stay here where I was because I feel like, you know, now I have to kind of close the gap here. And so some people are good at being the spearhead for that, and some people need to have, you know, more than a kick in the pants to get them to do it. So in looking at all the stuff you've written and all the feedback you've gotten from people directly and indirectly, you know, websites and what lectures and stuff, the one constant I see is people want a formula. They want, you know, the five steps to wealth. They want the three steps to, you know, think like Einstein. And I just always find that is the quickest way to go nowhere. Because what happens is that's somebody else's recipe. That's somebody else's cookbook. And the ingredients that you use, you know, is going to be drawn from your own experiences. So how do you get that general idea across to people that there is no, you know, magic step? There is no, you know, secret, so to speak. Oh, law of attraction, let me sit still and think of, visualize the red lights on the post road, and then everything will be great. It's just that instant gratification. There's an inner work, there's a process that has to go on that becomes sort of practice. And I don't know how to get the result and the process on the same level with people, because they want the instant result, and they don't want to think about the process, and then they want the outcome without having to engage in anything that they do on a regular basis. So it's that quick fix mentality that just seems to be pervasive in anything in self-help.
Well, I agree with you in that. And here's the thing that I've learned over 30 years, 30-plus years of being a therapist. Everybody finds their own moment for that change. Like, somebody will be listening to your radio show, and they'll hear one thing you said, and they may turn that into a formula even. It doesn't even matter. That's the one thing that gets them off the dime, and they start to change. Or they read something in a book, or they hear somebody, one of their friends says something. Something gets them to change, and it isn't. You know, it may even be they start with a formula. They start with the five steps to do this, and that maybe works a little, but it starts to get the change process going. So I'm not so down on the five-step people as you are, because you're right. Each person is a total unique individual, and those five steps aren't going to work exactly for them. But if it gets them started, that's good enough for me, and then they can go find out what really works for them once they get going, because I think the hardest thing, just what you were saying, is people are frightened of change. Change is hard for people sometimes. And just to start the change process, then they're more open to new things, and maybe they're more open to listening to themselves and trusting themselves a little more, so they will find their own way. So I just figure whatever way they can use, even if it's a formula way, even if it's the five steps, is great with me. Anything to get you off the dime and get you moving.
Well, I think this applies, that we could shift it more to looking at those mysterious things called others. When you're dealing with, I'm okay, you're not okay. You know, you're dealing with, you know, someone who's, you know, they're angry all the time, and it's like you have to constantly deal with the other person's limitation. Well, and I guess this comes up a little bit with the election, dealing with special needs families. Is how do you not stigmatize the other person's problem to the point where that becomes like the third person in the room? You, me, and your alcoholism. You, me, and your workaholism. And
I just,
that angry enabler that seems to be around all the time, almost sort of the external critic. How do you deal with other people who are unwilling to change? That are in your midst.
I just have great, great empathy and sympathy for them because I've been in that very same place myself. So I don't go righteous on them and think, man, why don't you get your shit stuff together? Sorry.
It's okay.
It's the Internet, please. Yeah.
Okay, it's the Internet. Okay, all right, we can do that. Why don't you get your shit together and change? I think, man, I've been in like that place. I've been in a fearful place. I've been in a stuck place. I've been all messed up. And, you know, I just say, wow, it sounds like you're in a tough place. I hope you can change. I don't want to judge you for where you are. Even if I totally think it's a screwy place for you to be, even if I disagree with how you're thinking or how you're acting, you know, I don't want you to hurt anybody or hurt yourself, and I'll do what I can to kind of protect that. But otherwise, you know, I've been in tough places myself. I've been in defensive places myself. I've been in stuck places. I've been in selfish places. And I think, man, I know what that feels like from the inside. And I just have great sympathy for you. I don't think it's leading in a good place. And, you know, it's like all this politics stuff. I think, you know, that Sarah Palin comes out and her daughter's pregnant and people are thinking, oh, should we use this as a political thing? I think, man, I've had family problems. I've had people in my family have done things that, you know, put me in an awkward position, or I've done things with my family that put them in an awkward position. I understand that. I may not agree with the politics, but, man, I understand when you get into a tough place or when you're in an embarrassing situation, I just go totally heart-filled at that point and just totally sympathetic and say, I get it. It's not that you're not responsible for what you do, but I feel great sympathy for you in this dilemma that you're in right now. I just go loving and empathic on it.
Wow. I guess the pissed part of me says that's the perfect way to get punched in the nose about 10 times, but, you know.
Well, I mean, you know, you don't have to make yourself a victim of it, but from, you know, from afar, sometimes I don't hang around those people. I say, you know what? I'm not going to let you in my house because you're going to steal my stuff and sell it for your heroin addiction, but I really don't need to judge you about it. I don't need to think, what a bad person. I'd never do anything like that. Why don't they get their stuff together? I could have been in that place. I had a friend who worked in a men's prison in Maine. He'd worked there for 25 years as a therapist. He said, I've seen psychologists, psychiatrists, chaplains, social workers come and go, and they all get burned out or scared here, he said. I've been here 25 years, and I love it. And he said, the reason I love it is that I can find something to love in each of these guys. And he said, some of them should never be let out of prison, definitely. They're dangerous people. But he said, I also think, but for a couple of different circumstances in my childhood and a couple of different choices as I was growing up, I could have been in here. So, you know, I don't judge these guys. And they know I don't judge them. So they respect me and they work well with me. So I think that's the way to approach people, because if you approach people in a judgmental way, they're less likely to change. They get more defensive. They get more adamant on their I'm right, you're wrong stance. And I figure just come to them with sympathy and caring and kindness, and maybe they'll listen to something you have to say.
So, okay, so then you do have a little bit of a disclaimer, caveat, or kind of a cul-de-sac on your website about when you're doing work with someone one-on-one, or whether you're dealing with possibility therapy as a general idea, there's certain people that you will not engage in when they have a destructive thing going on, or they have, you know, this is where I have to call in Chris Avell as like the referee. You know, when you're dealing with the card-carrying and schizophrenics that are loose in the population, which some of them are drug-induced and some of them got there on their own merit. So how do you know when you're dealing with someone who has the same faculties as you, even though we're all limited, we're all flawed, we're all dealing with our own deals
right.
and stuff, when you honestly look at someone and you say, there's just rooms in there that they don't even go into, and how do you just say, I've got to call in a third party here, I've got to get some help? Because I see people trying to be sort of almost like, in a way, kind of meta-professionals, where they're reading the self-help books, they're watching Oprah, they're getting advice from Dr. Phil, and then they're running and inflicting it on all their neighbors. And then, you know, half of them are popping Prozac and reading The Secret. So it just seems like not so much blind leading the blind, but the confused leading the confused anyway. So how do you get to the point where you can put your feet on the ground and say, I'm responsible for, you know, how I experience you, And I want to understand if that person can't, it's like there's no copy on the other side of that CB radio, then There's nobody over there. I've got to realize what that is. Oh, maybe one of them's calling us now. All right, put them through. Let's see.
There you go.
You're on the air with Bill O'Hanlon and Naked Summer. Go ahead.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you.
It's Richard from Massachusetts.
Okay.
I got to tell you, you've described every family member I've ever had.
Perhaps
I mean, you can't do that. Don't do that. You'll get hurt. You got to do this. Mm-hmm.
Have you stood up to him? Have you stood up to that and made changes anyway?
Oh, I left them years ago.
Your answer, Dr. Mark. You just got an expert on the line right here. You say some of those people you just decide you're not going to hang out with anymore because they bring you down too much, or they'll try and drag you down with them. I would say, you got to get your distance. You can say, I feel sympathy for those people, I love those people, and I'm getting the heck out of here.
Well, you haven't heard the worst of it. I was 18 years old when I left, and what I left for was a disaster. I went to Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
I thought you left
a dysfunctional family for the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
I'd say they were pretty bad company then. Okay.
Well, no, not really, because it was part of my learning process. But the point is that I knew I had made a bad decision once they started shooting at me. So I said, well, let me get out of this one, too.
The people I was living with weren't shooting at me. They weren't very fun, but they weren't shooting at me.
So somewhere in Southeast Asia, you're going, those arguments at the dinner table aren't so bad. Holy cow.
I heard this story, Richard, about they did a study of people that jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge and survived, and they wanted to know whether they had anything in common, and they did all these studies, and they couldn't find anything in common except they all, on the way down, they didn't see their life flashing in front of their eyes or anything. They all had the thought, maybe this wasn't such a good idea. So when you got to Vietnam, I bet that was one of your thoughts. Maybe this wasn't such a good idea.
Exactly right. But you haven't heard the full course of the solution. I mean, I'm 62 years old now.
Uh-huh.
And over the years, I did a lot of things that maybe I shouldn't have done. But one of the things that it took chances and stuff. But one of the things that happened to me was that I got sick, and I went to one doctor after another, and I got so pissed at these doctors. These guys are so stupid, they can't think. So I started studying medicine. And what happened was that I was asking the wrong questions, and I recognized that they were being patterned. So I asked different questions. They based their ideas on how do you get well. Well, my question was, how do you get sick? And, as soon as I asked that question, bells and whistles started going off. And I've been at this for 30 years. Now, that's still not the end of the question. Now, I'm such an expert at heavy metal poisoning that my wife accused me of creating a new religion. Nobody wants to talk to me because, I analyze everybody I see. Well, you've been affected by mercury, and you've been affected by lead and fluoride and on and on and on. So it's, it's a constant struggle. There's no end to it.
So all you have to do is write a book and be an expert, and then they'll pay you. They won't get annoyed with you. They'll pay you. All the people will flock to you that want that knowledge. So
I did that too.
He just writes another book.
I just write another book. What the heck? I'd call mine. Get the lead out. How to deal with heavy metal poisoning and keep Ozzy Osbourne out of your life.
As soon as you said that you got people, as soon as you change your environment to make a different decision, I got it. I mean, I believed it. And it's not that I'm an expert at it. I'm an expert at other things. But you hit the nail right on the head.
Mm-hmm. All right, Richard. Well, thanks for calling us here. We're going to let you go. And thanks for listening.
Richard. No problem.
Keep listening.
All right.
Yeah. Okay, now you see what I mean.
Yeah.
How do you know when you're dealing with 52 cards on the other side of that deck? Because people have extreme experiences like Vietnam and heavy metal poisoning.
You take people at face value, and I think one of the things is you start to joke with them. Like I was making jokes about heavy metal and Ozzy Osbourne.
Yeah.
I was going to make another joke when he said you hit the nail on the head. I said, I hope that nail doesn't have heavy metals in it. You know, that would have been my next joke. So, you know, you see, if people can laugh, it's a sign of mental health. If they can't laugh, you go, uh-oh, I think they may be a little too serious here, and that gives you one hint that they may be one card shy of 52 cards. And then if they start to lecture at you and they start to act a little dangerously, then there's a couple of more cards missing from the deck, and you say, okay, trust in God, but lock your car. I mean, we gotta deal with the physical reality here, and don't let this person walk all over us. That's it.
Wow. Well, if anyone's listening back on the archive here, if you want a tutorial on how to deal with the not-so-normal, Richard, you know, you're just like us, a little left to center. If you're listening to Naked Soma on a Wednesday night, you're not going to be standing in the jury duty line tomorrow. So it's again, this is that self.
How do you deal with him every week?
Every week. There's one standing in the office about 10 minutes ago wanting to vacuum the office while I'm on the phone. So.
He's got the patience of a saint.
I'm pissed and dissed or whatever the heck you said before. Believe me, I'm just eco.
Well, at least you're alive, Dr. Mark. At least
that's right. And I will pledge allegiance to that one. So, please score. All right. We're up 8-7 here.
Finally.
The guy made a diving catch, too. That could have been a big run there.
It's freaking mess, man.
Well, it's pennant race stuff. I've got pennant fever like you wouldn't believe. I should have, like, boils all over my body from all the baseball I've watched in the last 2 weeks. See, I got involved in the sports profiling show, so now I have to compare and contrast everybody's basic, somatic profiles every weekend.
Right.
So I'm like, it's almost like chocolate cake with just all icing. I can't just watch the game. I have to like profile the game while I'm watching it, take notes, and then blog about it and talk about it with these crazy baseball fans that want to kill me because they're all stats people.
See, and I would write a book about that. I'd call it The Profiler, The Profiler, life as a baseball profile, profiler.
How many books you got, like 29 books or something?
I got 29 books, and I got about 10 more outlined in my computer. Stop me before I write again.
My God. See, the thing is, like, do you know if your audience is something you could pinpoint them? Because the way that the author community, you do teach a lot of people how to write their own book and get published and all that stuff, which is great.
I teach them how to write books, how to become speakers and all that stuff. But, yeah, I think I have different audiences. I write about trauma. I write about couples therapy. I write about psychotherapy. I write about kind of self-help books. And so I have different audiences for different things. I just wrote a book about how to write a book. So that's a totally different audience.
Yeah, I mean, as I'm saying, you're able, because, again, applying your own theory, the possibility guy, you're able to say, I'm not going to get pigeonholed into my target market. And this is one of our frustrations with this work is it's kind of tofu. We hang out by people that, you know, look at movies for cinema therapy, and we could look at them and use the movies as our motif, or we could do the sports stuff or the political stuff, or we could just focus on your horrible mother-in-law that forces you to go, join the army. We don't really have, we're not context-free, but we're kind of carefree about the context. Whatever context we're in, you're the constant. So I always kind of give people that equation, like, I don't care where you are, who are you, when, that, where? And riding them through that awareness is kind of what the tools are, and that's what you're saying. You broke it down again. What were those things, the blessed, pissed, and what?
Yeah, it's four of them. It's bliss, bless, piss, and diss. That's my soundbite. That's my soundbite for the night.
Okay. And those are personality profiles for you? Those are just like underlying, like basically temperaments?
No, they're just energies. They're just energies.
Okay.
And I think they change through life. Sometimes you're bliss, sometimes you're pissed, sometimes it's a combination of it. So as you said, you mostly hang out on the bliss and piss side, but maybe on the piss and diss side, but maybe you're blissed about sports. Who knows?
We get six more apps, I'll be blissed.
There you go.
I was blessed at 6 o'clock when the Phillies lost.
For a short time, huh?
Yeah, until I go to the postgame show.
Until they blow it again, huh?
Right, exactly. Well, there's 162 of these things, these little experiments called baseball games. But anyway, like I said, I think to kind of close up shop for us, we're getting close to the top of the hour.
All right.
We always try to end on a misconception.
All right.
So someone walks into Borders or, you know, one of these bookstores or goes on Amazon and stumbles across your name. Because you have such an eclectic history with all kinds of little lily pads you've jumped from, What is the one common misconception about you, not your work, you, Bill Hamlin, author, that you'd like to maybe clear up to all your audiences here at once as they eavesdrop on our conversation?
Well, I think you actually said it just a couple of minutes ago, that there's I've done so many things, but it's all following the energy from me. And, you know, there's this, like, he's jumping all over the place, and he's all interested in all this stuff, and he's opportunistic. He's got interest in this. Why doesn't he focus? For me, that is the commonality is just me. What I've been interested in, there's a thread that runs through it. And here's the thread that runs through my whole life and my whole work. There's nothing as dangerous as an idea when it's the only one you have.
Oof-a.
Wow.
Ooh, there's a bumper sticker. I'm bad. That's going up on the fridge tomorrow to scare my daughter. She's got the world figured out at 12.
Yeah, really.
I had the world figured out for 12, and then 13 came, and I started over again.
So. It started with uncertainty again, yeah.
Well, they had one false move. It should be titled my autobiography. Wow. Well, this went really quick.
I had a great time with you, too.
Well, you're going to have to come back
again. I saw
again.
You dominated the conversation, Val. You know, that was
you
know
Mark
what?
And I were just couldn't get a word in edgewise.
Yeah.
When it comes to interviewing, he's so good. I just sit back and enjoy.
She picks her spots and corrects my grammar mostly at this point.
Yeah, that's
screw yourself.
Yeah. There you go. Now we'll have our bickering. Yeah. All right, well, Bill, thanks for joining us. Hopefully we'll get
thanks,
you on again, and we'll bat some of these ideas around again when your next book comes out, which will be about five minutes.
See you later.
Take care, man.
All right, bye-bye. Thanks.
Wow. All right, what was that now? Bliss?
Pissed? Dissed? What's the other one? Damn it.
Crap.
Blessed. Blessed.
All right,
crap.
It seems to coincide with the old four of the usual
Yes, I was about to say that, but, you know, how dare I draw the line.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
I don't want to say anything about that.
Which one can I be today? I'm kind of onto today.
I'll signify by saying,
Before we adjourn for the evening, I just want to give a shout-out to my new students, because I'm sure some of them will be listening.
Yeah.
Hi, kids.
They're listening, right? They're listening.
Yeah, they are. I'm sure they are.
You know, here's to the next earthquake. Who knows? But see, one thing I got out of talking to him was that as long as you have a keyboard, you have an outlet.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wild pitch!
Wow.
And here comes another run!
Hello.
We are playing the Nationals. Oh,
indeed.
A beautiful thing!
Yay.
Yes.
Yeah, Charlie! Candy Mountain! It's a man of sweets and joy and joyness.
Please stop bouncing on.
You see? I just went to Blessed. Wasn't a four trip from Pissed. Wow.
That was good.
Well, I will have to get into an email dialogue with Bill over this in the domains. Maybe we could put, you know, a toe in each water here and come up with a way to get me to finish my book before I'm dead.
I think that would be a fabulous idea.
He seems to have no fear.
None.
He faces
I
life.
I like him.
He faces life like this.
We're going to keep him. Oh, man.
It's Bill Hamlin just going through the problems.
That's
and
the
Mets have scored two more.
It's 11. Wow. 7-11.
10-7. No, 11.
Yeah.
11-7. The Mets with four in the seventh. That was the first out of the inning? Holy cow. Second out. That was Shinida, the Philo, flailing to the left field there. Wow.
Jeez.
Unbelievable.
Wow.
This is good. Let's see
this
if we get a quote for that. There you go.
Fitzy. Take that, Fitzy.
Fitzy, I haven't seen any reactions to the Tom Brady injury yet. I'm waiting.
Yeah, me too. He's probably crying.
All right, guys. So next week we have more fun and games. Who is the guest next week, by the way?
I don't know. Let me see if I can bring up my Google thing here.
All right. Because Bill is a big deal. And
he's a huge deal.
Oh, boy, I'm gushing.
I know you are. Mm. All right, here's our calendar. Let's take, what the hell did I do? Ugh. Okay.
58 seconds.
Yeah, I'm trying. Hush, bet. All right. Of course, we have to make sure that we're actually still part of the Earth next week, so this is
continuing. Well, yeah, if there's more earthquakes If Blog Talk Radio was on, we'll be here at 9 o'clock next Wednesday night to
right.
You know, travel light, as we say.
That's
do
right.
Do we have the guest
all
yet?
Right. Damn it. I'm looking. Listen, don't bust my. You know what? I don't see it on here. I don't know how the hell this damn thing works.
Well, you know.
I don't want to talk to these cocksuckers, but you have to. In life, you have to do a lot of things you don't fucking want to do. Many times, that's what the fuck life is. One vile fucking task after another. But don't get aggravated. Then the enemy has you by the short hair.
All right, I found it.
Who is it?
It's Daniel. Let me see, where the heck is it? I just lost it again.
Oh, the somatic resource guy.
Dr. Daniel, what was his name?
I don't know. He's a guy on the West Coast talks about somatic resourcing, a very detailed, elaborate protocol that we will be picking apart, dealing with strengths and dealing with things like that. So,
right. Well,
you know,
we're already off the air, so for you guys that are still listening, why don't you ever contact us? What is wrong with you? Stop sitting silently.
Yep.
Damn it.
NakedSummer@gmail.com.
Right.
So, you know, for everyone still archiving, we'll see you next week. Travel light.
Bye.